One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Welcome to Dr. Creepin's dungeon. Well, it has been said that there are horrors beyond life's edge that we do not suspect, and once in a while man's evil prying calls them just within our range. Four stories of just such prying for you this evening from the masters of horror. William F. Harvey, W.W. Jacobs, Robert E. Howard, and Clark Ashton Smith. We begin tonight's podcast with Across the Moors by Harvey. But before we begin, as ever, a word of caution. Tonight's tales may contain strong language, as well as descriptions of acts of a horrific and violent nature. If that sounds like your kind of thing, then let's begin. It really was most unfortunate. Peggy had a temperature of nearly 100, and a pain in her side, and Mrs. Workington Bancroft knew that it was appendicitis. But there was no one whom she could send for the doctor. James had gone with the jaunting car to meet her husband, who had at last managed to get away for a week's shooting. Adolf, she'd sent to the Evershams only half an hour before, with a note for Lady Eva. The cook could not manage to walk, even if dinner could be served without her. Kate, as usual, was not to be trusted. And there remained Miss Craig. "Of course, you must see that Peggy is really ill," said she, as the governess came into the room in answer to her summons. "The difficulty is that there is absolutely no one whom I can send for the doctor." Mrs. Workington Bancroft paused. She was always willing that those beneath her should have the privilege of offering the services which it was her right to command. "So, perhaps, Miss Craig," she went on, "you wouldn't mind walking over to Tebbit's farm. I hear there's a Liverpool doctor staying there. Of course I know nothing about him, but we must take the risk, and I expect he'll be only too glad to be earning something during his holiday. It's nearly 4 miles away, I know, and I'd never dream of asking you if it was not that I dread appendicitis so." "Very well," said Miss Craig. "I suppose I must go, but I don't know the way." "Oh, you can't miss it," said Mrs. Workington Bancroft, in her anxiety temporarily forgiving the obvious unwillingness of her governess's consent. "You follow the road across the moor for 2 miles, until you come to Red Man's Cross. You turn to the left there, and follow a rough path that leads through a larch plantation, and Tebbit's farm lies just below you in the valley. Oh, and take Pontiff with you," she added, as the girl left the room. "There's absolutely nothing to be afraid of, but I expect you'll feel happier with the dog." "Well, miss," said the cook when Miss Craig went into the kitchen to get her boots, which had been drying by the fire. "Of course she knows best, but I don't think it's right that, after all that's happened, for the mistress to send you across the moors on a night like this. It's not as if the doctor could do anything for Miss Margaret if you do bring him. Every child is like that once in a while. He'll only say, 'Put her to the bed,' and she's there already." "Oh, I don't see what there is to be afraid of, cook," said Miss Craig as she laced her boots. "Unless you believe in ghosts." "Oh, I'm not so sure about that. Anyhow, I don't like sleeping in a bed where the sheets are too short for you to pull them over your head. But don't you be frightened, miss. It's my belief that their bark is worse than their bite." But though Miss Craig amused herself for some minutes by trying to imagine the bark of a ghost, a thing altogether different from the classical ghostly bark, she didn't feel entirely at ease. She was naturally nervous, and living as she did in the hinterland of the servants' hall, She'd heard vague details of true stories that were only myths in the drawing room. The very name of Redman's Cross sent a shiver through her. It must have been the place where that horrid murder was committed. She'd forgotten the tale, though. She remembered the name. Her first disaster came soon enough. Pontiff, who was naturally slow-witted, took more than 5 minutes to find out that it was only the governess he was escorting. But once the discovery had been made, he promptly turned tail, paying not the slightest heed to Miss Craig's feeble whistle. And then, to add to her discomfort, the rain came. Not in heavy drops, but driving in sheets of thin spray that blotted out what few landmarks there were upon the moor. They were very kind at Tebbit's farm. The doctor had gone back to Liverpool the day before, but Mrs. Tebbit gave her hot milk and turf cakes, and had ordered her reluctant son to show Miss Craig a shorter path onto the moor, one that avoided the larch wood. Well, he was a monosyllabic youth, but his presence was cheering, and she felt the night doubly black when he left her at the last gate. She trudged on wearily. Her thoughts had already gone back to the almost exhausted theme of the bark of ghosts, when she heard steps on the road behind her that were at least material. Next minute, the figure of a man appeared. Miss Craig was relieved to see that the stranger was a clergyman. He raised his hat. "Oh, I believe we're both going in the same direction," he said. "Perhaps I may have the pleasure of escorting you." She thanked him. "It is a rather weird at night," she went on. "And what with all the tales of ghosts and bogies that one hears from the country people, I've ended by being half afraid myself." "Oh, I can understand your nervousness," he said, "especially on a night like this. I used to, at one time, feel the same, for my work often meant lonely walks across the moor to farms which are only reached by rough tracks difficult enough to find even in the daytime." "And you never saw anything to frighten you? Nothing immaterial, I mean?" "I can't really say that I did, but I had an experience 11 years ago which served as a turning point in my life. And since you seem to be now in much the same state of mind I was then, I'll tell you. The time of year was late September. I'd been over to Westendale to see an old woman who was dying, and then, just as I was about to start on my way home, word came to me of another of my parishioners who'd been suddenly taken ill only that morning. It was after 7 when at last I started. A farmer saw me on the way, turning back when I reached the moor road. The sunset the previous evening had been one of the most lovely I ever remember seeing. The whole vault of heaven had been scattered with flakes of white cloud, tipped with rosy pink like the strewn petals of a full-blown rose. But that night, all was changed. The sky was an absolutely dull slate colour, except in one corner of the west where a thin rift showed the last saffron tint of the sullen sunset. As I walked, stiff and footsore, my spirit sank. It must have been the marked contrast between the two evenings, the one so lovely, so full of promise. The corn was still out in the field, spoiling for fine weather, and the other, so gloomy, so sad, with all the dead weight of autumn and winter days to come. And then added to this sense of heavy depression came another different feeling, which I surprised myself by recognizing as fear. I do not know why I was afraid. The moors lay on either side of me, unbroken except for a straggling line of turf shooting butts that stood within a stone's throw of the road. The only sound I heard for the last half hour was the cry of the startled grouse. "Go back, go back, go back." But yet the feeling of fear was there, affecting a low center of my brain through some little-used physical channel. I buttoned my coat closer and tried to divert my thoughts by thinking of next Sunday's sermon. I had chosen to preach on Job. There's much in the old-fashioned notion of the book, apart from all the subtleties of the higher criticism, that appeals to country people, the loss of herds and crops, the breakup of the family. I would not have dared to speak had not I too been a farmer. My own glebe land had been flooded 3 weeks before, and I suppose I stood to lose as much as any man in the parish. As I walked along the road, repeating to myself the first chapter of the book, I stopped at the 12th verse. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Now the thought of the bad harvest, and that is an awful thought in these valleys, vanished. I seemed to gaze into an ocean of infinite darkness. Now I'd often used with the Sunday glibness of the tired priest, whose duty it is to preach 3 sermons in one day, the old simile of the chessboard. God and the devil were the players, and we were helping one side or the other. But until that night, I'd not thought of the possibility of my being only a pawn in the game, that God might throw away, that the game might be won. Well, I'd reached the place where we are now. I remember it by that rough stone water trough, when a man suddenly jumped out from the roadside. He'd been seated on a heap of broken road metal. Oh, which way are you going, Governor? He said. I knew from the way he spoke that the man was a stranger. There are many at this time of the year who come from the south, trampling northwards with the ripening corn. I told him my destination. We will go along together, he replied. It was too dark to see much of the man's face, but what little I made out was coarse and brutal. Then he began the half-menacing whine I know so well. He trampled miles that day. He'd had no food since breakfast, and that was only a crust. Oh, give us a copper, he said. It's only for a night's lodging. Well, he was whittling away with a big clasp knife at an ash stake he'd taken from some hedge. The clergyman broke off. Oh, are those the lights of your house? He said. We're nearer than I expected, but I shall have time to finish my story. I think I will, for you can run home in a couple of minutes, and I don't want you to be frightened when you're out on the moors again. So, as the man talked, he seemed to have stepped out of the very background of my thoughts, his sordid tale with the sad lies that hid a far sadder truth. He asked me the time. It was 9:05. As I replaced my watch, I glanced at his face. His teeth were clenched, and there was something in the gleam of his eyes that told me at once his purpose. Now, have you ever known how long a second is? For a third of a second, I stood there facing him, filled with an overwhelming pity for myself and him. And then, without a word of warning, he was upon me. I felt nothing. A flash of lightning ran down my spine. I heard the dull crash of the ash stake, and then a very gentle patter like the sound of a far distant stream. For a minute I lay in perfect happiness, watching the lights of the house as they increased in number, until the whole heaven shone with twinkling lamps. I could not have had a more painless death. Miss Gregg looked up. The man was gone. She was alone on the moor. She ran to the house, her teeth chattering, ran to the solid shadow that crossed and recrossed the kitchen blind. She entered the hall. The clock on the stairs struck the hour. It was 9:00.
Now, as a doctor of the weird and macabre, I'm sure you can understand why I value my own privacy and why I like to remain incognito as much as possible. And that's why I value internet privacy just as much. So did you know your internet service provider can see every single site that you've ever visited? That's even if you use incognito mode. Even when you've cleared out your browser history, it doesn't matter which provider you use either. Did you know in the UK, for example, the law actually requires that all of your metadata from the past year is kept? Now isn't that a horrifying prospect? What's the solution? There is a good way of rerouting and encrypting your internet connection through the ExpressVPN secure servers so that your internet provider can't see all of the sites that you visit. And it doesn't matter what device you use, ExpressVPN can be the game changer that you've been looking for. So why use ExpressVPN? Well, it's best in its class in encryption, protecting your data 100%. And it runs seamlessly in the background, doesn't cause any lagging or buffering, and it's extremely easy to use. It's been rated the number one VPN by CNET and Wired, and all it requires is a tap of a button, and you are fully protected. As I said, doesn't matter which device you use, your phone, your computer, it's available on all your devices. So, go to expressvpn.com/creep, and you can now get an extra 3 months free on a 1 year package. That's expressvpn.com/creep. One more time, expressvpn.com/creep. So you and your secrets remain protected. What a reminder in our first tale to be careful where you walk and at what time you go out walking. Never walk across the moors at night. Now on to our second tale of terror, The Well, by W.W. Jacobs. Two men stood in the billiard room of an old country house, talking. Play, which had been of a half-hearted nature, was over, and they sat down at the open window, looking out over the park stretching away beneath them, conversing idly. "Your time's nearly up, Jem," said one at length. "This time 6 weeks, you'll be yawning out of the honeymoon and cursing the man, woman I mean, who invented them." Jem Benson stretched his long limbs in the chair and grunted in dissent. "I've never understood it," continued Wilfred Carr, yawning. "It's not in my line at all. I never had money enough for my own wants, let alone for two. Perhaps if I were as rich as you or Croesus, I might regard it differently." There was sufficient meaning in the latter part of the remark for his cousin to forbear to reply to it. He continued to gaze out of the window and to smoke slowly. "Not being as rich as Croesus or you," resumed Carr, regarding him from beneath lowered lids, "I paddle my own canoe down the stream of time, and tying it to my friend's doorposts, go in to eat their dinners." "Quite Venetian," said Jem Benson, still looking out of the window. "It's not a bad thing for you, Wilfred, that you have the doorposts and dinners and, well, friends." Carr grunted in his turn. "Seriously, though, Jem," he said slowly, "you're a lucky fellow, a very lucky fellow. If there's a better girl above ground than Olive, I should like to see her." "Yes," said the other, quietly. "Well, she's an exceptional girl," continued Carr, staring out of the window. "She's so good and gentle. She thinks you are a bundle of all the virtues." He laughed frankly and joyously, but the other man did not join him. "Strong sense of right and wrong, though," continued Carr, musingly. "Do you know, I believe that if she found out what you were not, "Not what?" demanded Benson, turning upon him fiercely. "Not what?" "Oh, everything that you are," returned his cousin with a grin that belied his words. "Well, I believe she'd drop you." "Talk about something else," said Benson slowly. "Your pleasantries are not always in the best taste." Wilfred Carr rose and, taking a cue from the rack, bent over the board and practiced one or two favourite shots. "The only other subject I can talk about just at present is my own financial affairs," he said slowly, as he walked round the table. "Talk about something else," Benson said again, bluntly. "Oh, and the two things are connected," said Carr. Dropping his cue, he half sat on the table and eyed his cousin. There was a long silence. Benson pitched the end of his cigar out of the window and, leaning back, closed his eyes. "Do you, follow me?" inquired Carr at length. Benson opened his eyes and nodded at the window. "Do you want to follow my cigar?" he demanded. "Oh, I should prefer to depart by the usual way for your sake," returned the other, unabashed. "If I left by the window, all sorts of questions would be asked, and you know how talkative a chap I am."
Oh, so long as you don't talk about my affairs, returned the other, restraining himself by an obvious effort. You can talk yourself hoarse. I'm in a mess, said Carr slowly. A devil of a mess. If I don't raise 1,500 by this day fortnight, I may be getting my board and lodging free. Would that be any change? Questioned Benson. Well, the quality would, retorted the other. The address would also not be good. Seriously, Jem, will you let me have the 1,500?
No, said the other simply. Carr went white.
It's to save me from ruin, he said thickly.
I've helped you till I'm tired, said Benson, turning and regarding him, and it is all to no good. If you've got into a mess, get out of it. You should not be so fond of giving autographs away.
Yeah, it's foolish, I admit, said Carr deliberately. I won't do so any more. Oh, by the way, I've got some to sell. You needn't sneer, they're not my own.
Whose are they? Inquired the other.
Oh, well, yours.
Benson got up from his chair and crossed over to him. What is this? He asked quietly. Blackmail?
Call it what you like, said Carr. I've got some letters for sale. Price, 1,500. And I know a man who would buy them at that price for the mere chance of getting Olive from you. Well, I'll give you first offer.
If you've got any letters bearing my signature, you'll be good enough to give them to me, said Benson, very slowly.
They're mine, said Carr lightly. Given to me by the lady you wrote them to. Oh, I must say they are not all in the best possible taste.
His cousin reached forward suddenly and, catching him by the collar of his coat, pinned him down on the table.
Give me those letters, he breathed, sticking his face close to Carr's. Oh, they're not here, said Carr, struggling. I'm not a fool. Let me go or I'll raise the price.
The other man raised him from the table in his powerful hands, apparently with the intention of dashing his head against it. Then suddenly, his hold relaxed as an astonished-looking maidservant entered the room with letters. Carr sat up hastily.
That's how it was done, said Benson,
for the girl's benefit, as he took the letters.
Oh, I don't wonder at the other man making him pay for it, then, said Carr, blandly.
You will give me those letters? Asked Benson, suggestively, as the girl left the room.
At the price I mentioned, yes, said Carr. But so sure as I am a living man, if you lay your clumsy hands on me again, I'll double it. Now, I'll leave you for a time while you think it over.
He took a cigar from the box and, lighting it carefully, quitted the room. His cousin waited until the door had closed behind him and then, turning to the window, sat there in a fit of fury, as silent as it was terrible. The air was fresh and sweet from the park, heavy with the scent of new-mown grass. The fragrance of a cigar was now added to it, and glancing out, he saw his cousin pacing slowly by. He rose and went to the door, and then, apparently altering his mind, he returned to the window and watched the figure of his cousin as it moved slowly away into the moonlight. Then he rose again, and, for a long time, the room was empty. It was empty when Mrs. Benson came in some time later to say goodnight to her son on her way to bed. She walked slowly round the table and, pausing at the window, gazed from it in idle thought, until she saw the figure of her son advancing rapid strides toward the house. He looked up at the window.
"Good night,"
said she.
"Good night," said Benson in a deep voice. "Where is Wilfred?"
"Oh, he's gone," said Benson.
"Gone?"
"We had a few words. He was wanting money again, and I gave him a piece of my mind. I don't think we shall see him again."
"Oh, poor Wilfred," sighed Mrs. Benson. "He's always in trouble of some sort. I hope that you weren't too hard upon him. No more than he deserved, said her son sternly. Good night. The well, which had long ago fallen into disuse, was almost hidden by the thick tangle of undergrowth which ran riot at the corner of the old park. It was partly covered by the shrunken half of a lid, above which a rusty windlass creaked in company with the music of the pines when the wind blew strongly. The full light of the sun never reached it, and the ground surrounding it was moist and green when other parts of the park were gaping with the heat. Two people walking slowly round the park in the fragrant stillness of a summer evening strayed in the direction of the well. "Oh, no use going through this wilderness, Olive," said Benson, pausing on the outskirts of the pines and eyeing with some disfavour the gloom beyond. "Best part of the park," said the girl briskly. "Oh, you know it's my favourite spot." "I know you're very fond of sitting on the coping," said the man slowly, "and I wish you wouldn't. One day you'll lean back too far and fall in." "And then make the acquaintance of truth," said Olive lightly. "Come along." She ran from him and was lost in the shadow of the pines, the bracken crackling beneath her as her feet ran across it. Her companion followed slowly, and emerging from the gloom, saw her poised daintily on the edge of the well, with her feet hidden in the rank grass and nettles which surrounded it. She motioned her companion to take a seat by her side, and smiled softly as she felt a strong arm passed around her waist. "Oh, I like this place," said she, breaking a long silence. "It is so dismal, so uncanny. Do you know, I wouldn't dare sit there alone, Jem. I should imagine all sorts of dreadful things were hidden beneath those bushes and trees, waiting to spring out on me. Oh!" "Well, you'd better let me take you in," said her companion tenderly. "The well isn't always wholesome, especially in the hot weather. Let's make a move." The girl gave an obstinate little shake and settled herself more securely on her seat. "Smoke your cigar in peace," she said quietly. "I'm settled here for a quiet talk. Anything heard of Wilfred yet?"
Nothing.
Quite a dramatic disappearance, isn't it?" she continued. "Another scrape, I suppose, and another letter for you in the same old strain. Oh, dear Jem, help me out."
Jem Benson blew a cloud of fragrant smoke into the air, and holding his cigar between his teeth, brushed away the ash from his coat sleeves.
"I wonder what he would have done without you," said the girl, pressing his arm affectionately. "Gone under long ago, I suppose. When we're married, Jem, I will presume upon the relationship to lecture him. He is very wild, but he has his good points, the poor fellow."
"I never saw them," said Benson, with startling bitterness. "God knows, I never saw them."
"Well, he's nobody's enemy but his own," said the girl, startled by his outburst.
"You don't know much about him," said the other sharply. "He was not above blackmail, not above ruining the life of a friend to do himself a benefit. A loafer, a cur and a liar." The girl looked at him soberly but timidly and took his arm without a word, and they both sat silent while evening deepened into night, and the beams of the moon, filtering through the branches, surrounded them with a silver network. Her head sank upon his shoulder, till suddenly, with a sharp cry, she sprang to her feet.
"What was that?"
she cried breathlessly.
"What was what?"
demanded Benson, springing up and clutching her fast by the arm. She caught her breath and tried to laugh.
"You're hurting me, Jem."
His hold relaxed.
"What is the matter?"
he asked gently.
"What was it that startled you?" "I was startled," she said slowly, putting her hands on his shoulder. "I suppose the words I used just now were ringing in my ears, but I fancied that someone behind us whispered, 'Jem, help me out.'"
"Fancy," repeated Benson, and his voice shook. "These fancies are not good for you. You are frightened at the dark and the gloom of these trees. Let me take you back to the house. No, I'm not frightened, said the girl, reseating herself. I should never be really frightened of anything when you were with me, Jem. I'm surprised myself for being so silly. The man made no reply but stood, a strong, dark figure, a yard or two from the well, as though waiting for her to join him.
Come and sit down, sir,
cried Olive, patting the brickwork with her small white hand. One would think you didn't like your company. He obeyed slowly and took a seat by her side, drawing so hard at his cigar that the light of it shone upon his fare at every breath. He passed his arm, firm and rigid as steel, behind her, with his hand resting on the brickwork beyond.
Are you warm enough?
He asked tenderly, as she made a little movement.
Pretty fair, she shivered. One oughtn't to be cold at this time of year, but there's a cold, damp air comes up from that well.
As she spoke, a faint splash sounded from the depths below, and for the second time that evening, she sprang from the well with a little cry of dismay.
What is it now?
He asked in a fearful voice. He stood by her side and gazed at the well, as though half expecting to see the cause of her alarm emerge from it.
Oh, my bracelet,
she cried in distress.
My poor mother's bracelet. I've dropped it down the well.
Your bracelet, repeated Benson dully.
Your bracelet, the diamond one.
Oh, that was my mother's, said Olive. Oh, we can't get it back, surely.
Look, we must have the water drained off.
Your bracelet, repeated Benson stupidly.
Jem,
said the girl in terrified tones.
Dear Jem, what's the matter?
For the man she loved was standing, regarding her with horror. The moon which touched it was not responsible for all the whiteness of the distorted face, and she shrank back in fear to the edge of the well. He saw her fear and, by a mighty effort, regained his composure and took her hand.
Poor little girl, he murmured. You frightened me. I was not looking when you cried, and I thought that you were slipping from my arms. Down, down.
His voice broke, and the girl, throwing herself into his arms, clung to him convulsively.
There, there, said Benson fondly. Don't cry, don't cry.
Tomorrow, said Olive, half laughing, half crying, we'll all come round the well with hook and line and fish for it. It'll be quite a new sport.
No, we must try some other way, said Benson. You shall have it back.
How? Asked the girl.
You shall see, said Benson.
Tomorrow morning, at latest, you shall have it back. Till then, promise me that you will not mention your loss to anyone. Promise?
I promise, said Olive, wonderingly. But why not?
Well, it is of great value, for one thing. Well, there are many reasons. For one thing, it is my duty to get it for you.
Wouldn't you like to jump down for it?
She asked mischievously.
Listen.
She stooped for a stone and dropped it down.
Fancy being where that is now,
she said, peering into the blackness.
Fancy going round and round like a mouse in a pail, clutching at the slimy sides, with the water filling your mouth, and looking up to the little patch of sky above.
You'd better come in, said Benson very quietly. You're developing a taste for the morbid and horrible. The girl turned and, taking his arm, walked slowly in the direction of the house. Mrs. Benson, who was sitting in the porch, rose to receive them.
Oh, you shouldn't have kept her out so long,
she said chidingly.
Where have you been?
Oh, sitting on the well, said Olive, smiling, discussing our future.
I don't believe that place is healthy, said Mrs. Benson emphatically. I really think it might be filled in, Jem.
All right, said her son slowly. Pity it wasn't filled in long ago. He took the chair vacated by his mother as she entered the house with Olive, and with his hands hanging limply over the sides, sat in deep thought. After a time, he rose, and going upstairs to a room which was set apart for sporting requisites, selected a sea fishing line and some hooks, and stole softly downstairs again. He walked swiftly across the park in the direction of the well, turning before he entered the shadow of the trees to look back at the lighted windows of the house. Then, having arranged his line, he sat on the edge of the well and cautiously lowered it. He sat with his lips compressed, occasionally looking about him in a startled fashion, as though he half expected to see something peering at him from the belt of trees. Time after time, he lowered his line until, at length, in pulling it up, he heard a little metallic tinkle against the side of the well. He held his breath then, and forgetting his fears, drew the line in inch by inch, so as not to lose its precious burden. His pulse beat rapidly and his eyes were bright. As the line came slowly in, he saw the catch hanging to the hook, and with a steady hand drew the last few feet in. And then he saw that, instead of the bracelet, he'd hooked a bunch of keys. With a faint cry, he shook them from the hook into the water below and stood breathing heavily. Not a sound broke the stillness of the night. He walked up and down a bit and stretched his great muscles. Then he came back to the well and resumed his task. For an hour or more, the line was lowered without result. In his eagerness, he forgot his fears and, with eyes bent down the well, fished slowly and carefully. Twice the hook became entangled in something and was with difficulty released. It caught a third time, and all his efforts failed to free it. Then he dropped the line down the well and, with head bent, walked back toward the house. He went first to the stables at the rear, and then, retiring to his room for some time, paced restlessly up and down. And then, without removing his clothes, he flung himself upon the bed and fell into a troubled sleep. Long before anybody else was astir, he arose and stole softly downstairs. The sunlight was stealing in at every crevice and flashing in long streaks across the darkened rooms. The dining room into which he looked struck chill and cheerless in the dark yellow light which came through the lowered blinds. He remembered that it had been the same appearance when his father had laid dead in the house. Now, as then, everything seemed ghastly and unreal. The very chairs standing as their occupants had left them the night before seemed to be indulging in some dark communication of ideas. Slowly and noiselessly, he opened the hall door and passed into the fragrant air beyond. The sun was shining on the drenched grass and trees, and slowly vanishing white mist rolled like smoke about the grounds. For a moment he stood, breathing deeply the sweet air of the morning, and then walked slowly in the direction of the stables. The rusty creaking of a pump handle and a spatter of water upon the red-tiled courtyard showed that someone else was astir, and a few steps farther he beheld a brawny, sandy-haired man gasping wildly under severe self-infliction at the pump.
"Everything ready, George?" he asked quietly.
"Oh, yes, sir," said the man, straightening up suddenly and touching his forehead. "Bob's just finishing the arrangements inside. It's a lovely morning for a dip. Oh, that water in the well must be just icy."
"I'll be as quick as you can," said Benson impatiently.
"Aye, very good, sir," said George, burnishing his face harshly with a very small towel which had been hanging over the top of the pump. "Oi, hurry up, Bob."
In answer to his summons, a man appeared at the door of the stable with a coil of stout rope over his arm and a large metal candlestick in his hand.
"Just to try the air, sir," said George, following his master's glance. "Oh, a well gets rather foul sometimes, but if a candle can live down it, then a man can too."
His master nodded, and the man, hastily pulling up the neck of his shirt and thrusting his arms into his coat, followed him as he led the way slowly to the well.
"Beg pardon, sir," said George, drawing up to his side. "But you are not looking over and above well this morning. If you let me go down,
I'd enjoy the bath. No, said Benson peremptorily. You ain't fit to go down, sir, persisted his follower. I've never seen you look so before. Now, look, if...
Mind your business, said his master curtly.
Well, George became silent, and the three walked with swinging strides through the long, wet grass to the well. Bob flung the rope on the ground, and at a sign from his master, handed him the candlestick.
Oh, here's the line for it, sir, said Bob, fumbling in his pockets.
Benson took it from him and slowly tied it to the candlestick. Then he placed it on the edge of the well and, striking a match, lit the candle and began to slowly lower it.
Hold hard, sir, said George quickly, laying his hand on his arm. You must tilt it or the string will burn through.
Even as he spoke, the string parted and the candlestick fell into the water below.
Benson swore quietly.
I'll soon get another, said George, starting up.
Never mind. Look, the well's all right, said Benson.
It won't take a moment, sir,
said the other over his shoulder.
Look, are you the master here or am I? Said Benson hoarsely.
George came back slowly, a glance at his master's face stopping the protest upon his tongue, and he stood by watching him sulkily as he sat on the well and removed his outer garments. Both men watched him curiously, as having completed his preparations, he stood grim and silent, with his hands by his sides.
Oh, I wish you'd let me go, sir, said George, plucking up courage to address him. You ain't fit to go. You got a chill or something. I shouldn't wonder it's the typhoid. Oh, they've got it in the village bad.
For a moment, Benson looked at him angrily, and then his gaze softened.
Not this time, George, he said quietly.
He took the looped end of the rope and placed it under his arms, and sitting down, threw one leg over the side of the well.
How are you going to go about it, sir?
Queried George, laying hold of the rope and signing to Bob to do the same.
I'll call out when I reach the water, said Benson. Then pay out 3 yards more quickly so that I can get to the bottom.
Aye, very good, sir, answered Bo.
Their master threw the other leg over the coping and sat motionless. His back was turned toward the men as he sat with head bent, looking down the shaft. He sat for so long that George became uneasy.
All right, sir,
he inquired. Yes, said Benson slowly. If I tug at the rope, George, pull up at once.
Right, lower away.
The rope passed steadily through their hands until a hollow cry from the darkness below and a faint splashing warned them that he'd reached the water. They gave him 3 yards more and stood with a relaxed grasp and strained ears, waiting.
Oh, he's gone under, said Bob in a low voice.
The other nodded and, moistening his huge palms, took a firmer grip of the rope. Fully a minute passed, and the men began to exchange uneasy glances. And then a sudden tremendous jerk, followed by a series of feebler ones, nearly tore the rope from their grasp.
Pull!
Said George, placing one foot on the side and hauling desperately.
Pull! Pull! He's stuck fast! He's not coming! Pull!
In response to their terrific exertions, the rope came slowly in, inch by inch, until at length a violent splashing was heard, and at the same moment a scream of unutterable horror came echoing up the shaft.
God, what a weight he is, panted Bob. Oh, he's stuck fast or something. Keep still, sir, for heaven's sake, keep still.
For the taut rope was being jerked violently by the struggles of the weight at the end of it. Both men, with grunts and sighs, hauled it in foot by foot.
All right, sir, cried George cheerfully.
He had one foot against the well and was pulling manfully. The burden was nearing the top. A long pull and a strong pull, and the face of a dead man with mud in his eyes and nostrils came peering over the edge. Behind it was the ghastly face of his master. But this he saw too late, for with a great cry he let go of his hold of the rope and stepped back. The suddenness overthrew his assistant, and the rope tore through his hands. And there was a frightful splash.
"Oh, you fool!"
stammered Bob, and ran to the well helplessly.
"God, run!" cried George. "Run for another line!"
He bent over the coping and called eagerly down as his assistant sped back to the stable, shouting wildly. His voice re-echoed down the shaft, but all else was silence.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Oh, there's something always just a little bit scary about a well, isn't there? Now time for our penultimate tale of the macabre. Old Garfield's Heart by Robert E. Howard.
I was sitting on the porch when my grandfather hobbled out and sank down on his favorite chair with the cushioned seat, and began to stuff tobacco in his old corncob pipe. "I thought you'd been going to the dance," he said. "I'm waiting for Doc Blaine," I answered. "I'm going over to old man Garfield's with him." My grandfather sucked at his pipe a while before he spoke again. "Old Jim Purdy bad off?" "Doc says he has a chance." "Who's taking care of him?" "Joe Braxton, against Garfield's wishes, but somebody had to stay with him." My grandfather sucked his pipe noisily and watched the heat lightning playing away off up in the hills. And he said, "You think old Jim's the biggest liar in this county, don't you?" "He tells some pretty tall tales," I admitted. "Some of the things he claimed he took part in must have happened before he was born." "I came from Tennessee to Texas in 1870, my grandfather said abruptly. "I saw this town of Lost Knob grow up with nothing. There wasn't even a Long Hut store here when I came, but old Jim Garfield was here, living in the same place he lives now. Only then it was a log cabin. He don't look a day older now than he did the first time I saw him." "You never mentioned that before," I said in some surprise. "I knew you put it down to an old man's maunderings," he answered. "Old Jim was the first white man to settle in this country. He built his cabin a good 50 miles west of the frontier. God knows how he done it. These hills swarmed with Comanches back then. Yeah, I remember the first time I ever saw him. Even then, everyone called him Old Jim. Remember him telling me the same tales he told you? How he was at the Battle of San Jacinto when he was a youngster, and how he'd rode with you and Cameron and Jack Hayes. Only, I believe him and you don't." "That was so long ago," I protested. "Yeah, the last Indian raid through this country was in 1874, said my grandfather, engrossed in his own reminiscences. "I was in on that fight. So was old Jim. I saw him knock old Yellowtail off his Mustang at 700 yards with a buffalo rifle. But before that, I was with him in a fight up near the head of Locust Creek. A band of Comanches came down Mescatal, looting and burning. Rode through the hills and started back up Locust Creek, and a scout of us were hot on their heels. We ran onto them just at sundown in Mesquite Flat. Killed 7 of them, and the rest skinned out through the brush on foot. The 3 of our boys were killed, and Jim Garfield got a thrust in the breast with a lance. Oh, it was an awful wound. He lay like a dead man, and it seemed sure nobody could live after a wound like that. But an old Indian came out of the bush. When we aimed our guns at him, he made the peace sign and spoke to us in Spanish. Don't know why the boys didn't shoot him in his tracks. because our blood was heated with the fighting and killing, but something about him made us hold our fire. He said he wasn't a Comanche, but was an old friend of Garfield's and wanted to help him. He asked us to carry Jim into a clump of mesquite and leave him alone with him, and to this day, I don't know why we did, but we did. Oh, it was an awful time. The wounded moaning and calling for water. The staring corpses strewn about the camp, night coming on, and no way of knowing that the Indians wouldn't return when dark fell. We made camp right there, because the horses were fagged out, and we watched all night, but the Comanches didn't come back. I don't know what went on out in the mesquite where Jim Garfield's body lay, because I never saw that strange Indian again. But during the night, I kept hearing a weird moaning that wasn't made by the dying man. And an owl hooted from midnight till dawn. When at sunrise, Jim Garfield came walking out of the mesquite, pale and haggard but alive, and already the wound in his breast had closed and begun to heal. And since then, he's never mentioned that wound, nor that fight, nor the strange Indian who came and went so mysteriously. And he hasn't aged a bit. He looks now just like he did then, a man of about 50. In the silence that followed, a car began to purr down the road, and twin shafts of light cut through the dusk. "That's Doc Blaine," I said. "When I come back, I'll tell you how Garfield is." Doc Blaine was prompt with his predictions as we drove the 3 miles of post-oak-covered hills that lay between Lost Knob and the Garfield farm. "Well, I'll be surprised to see him alive," he said. "Oh, smashed up like he is. A man his age ought to have more sense than to try and break a young horse." "He doesn't look so old," I remarked. "I'll be 50 my next birthday," answered Doc Blaine. "I've known him all my life, and he must have been at least 50 the first time I ever saw him. His looks are deceiving." Old Garfield's dwelling place was reminiscent of the past. The boards of the low squat house had never known paint. Orchard fence and corrals were built of rails. Old Jim lay on his rude bed, tended crudely but efficiently by the man Doc Blaine had hired over the old man's protests. As I looked at him, I was impressed anew by his evident vitality. His frame was stooped but unwithered, his limbs rounded with springy muscles. In his corded neck and in his face, drawn though it was with suffering, was apparent an innate virility. His eyes, though partly glazed with pain, burned with the same unquenchable element. "He's been raving," said Joe Braxton stolidly. "First white man in this country," muttered old Jim, becoming intelligible. "Hills no white man ever set foot in before. Getting too old, have to settle down. Can't move on like I used to. Settle down here. Good country before it filled up with cowmen and squatters. I wish you and Cameron could see this country. Well, the Mexicans shot him, damn them." Doc Blaine shook his head. "He's all smashed up inside. He won't live till daylight." And Garfield unexpectedly lifted his head and looked at us with clear eyes. "Wrong, Doc," he wheezed, his breath whistling with pain. "Well, I'll live. What's broken bones and twisted guts? Nothing. It's the heart that counts. Long as the heart keeps pumping, a man can't die. My heart sound. Listen to it. Feel it." He groped painfully for Doc Blaine's wrist, dragged his hand to his bosom and held it there, staring up into the doctor's face with avid intensity. "Regular dynamo, ain't it?" he gasped. "Stronger than a gasoline engine." Blaine beckoned me. "Lay your hand here," he said, placing my hand on the old man's bare breast. "He does have a remarkable heart action." I noted, in the light of the coal oil lamp, a great livid scar in the gaunt arching breast, such a scar as might be made by a flint-headed spear. I laid my hand directly on this scar, and an exclamation escaped my lips. Under my old hand, Jim Garfield's heart pulsed, but its throb was like no other heart action I've ever observed. Its power was astounding. His ribs vibrated to its very throb. It felt more like the vibrating of a dynamo than the action of a human organ. I could feel its amazing vitality radiating from his breast, stealing up into my hand and up my arm, until my own heart seemed to speed up in response. "Oh, I can't die," old Jim gasped. "Not as long as my heart's in my breast. Only a bullet through the brain can kill me. Even then, I wouldn't be rightly dead, as long as my heart keeps beating in my breast. Yet it ain't rightly mine, either. It belongs to Ghostman, the Lipan chief. It was the heart of a god the Lipans worshipped before the Comanches drove him out of their native hills. I knew Ghostman down on the Rio Grande. When I was with you and Cameron, I saved his life from the Mexicans once. He tied the string of ghost wampum between him and me, the wampum no man but me and him can see or feel. He came when he knowed I needed him, and that fired up on the headwaters of Locust Creek when I got this scar. I was as dead as a man can be. My heart was sliced in two, like the heart of a butchered beast did. All night Ghostman did magic, calling my ghost back from Spiritland. I remember that fight, little. It was dark and gray-like, and I drifted through gray mists and heard the dead wailing past me in the mist. But Ghostman brought me back. He took out what was left of my mortal heart and put the heart of the god in my bosom. But it's his, and when I'm through with it, he'll come for it. He kept me alive and strong for the lifetime of a man. Age can't touch me. What do I care if these fools around here call me an old liar? What I know, I know. But hark ye. And his fingers became claws, clamping fiercely on Doc Blaine's wrist. His old eyes, old yet strangely young, burned fierce as those of an eagle under his bushy brows. If by some mischance I should die, now or later, promise me this. Go into my bosom and take out the heart Ghostman led me so long ago. It's his, and as long as it beats in my body, my spirit will be tied to that body. Let my head be crushed like an egg underfoot, a living thing in a rotten body. Promise? Alright, I promise, replied Doc Blaine to humor him, and old Jim Garfield sank back with a whistling sigh of relief. Well, he did not die that night, nor the next, nor the next. I well remember the next day because that was the day I had the fight with Jack Kirby. Now, people will take a good deal from a bully rather than to spill blood. Because nobody had gone to the trouble of killing him, Kirby thought the whole countryside was afraid of him. He'd bought a steer from my father, and when my father went to collect for it, Kirby told him that he paid the money to me, which was a lie. I went looking for Kirby, and came upon him in a bootleg joint, boasting of his toughness and telling the crowd that he was going to beat me up and make me say that he paid me the money, that I had to stick it into my own pocket. When I heard him say that, I saw red, and ran in on him with a stockman's knife and cut him across the face and in the neck, side, breast and belly. The only thing that saved his life was the fact that the crowd pulled me off. Well, there was a preliminary hearing, and I was indicted on a charge of assault. My trial was set for the following term of court. Well, Kirby was as tough-fibered as a post-oak country bully ought to be, and he recovered, swearing vengeance, for he was vain of his looks, though God knows why, and I had permanently impaired them. While Jack Kirby was recovering, old man Garfield recovered too, to the amazement of everybody, especially Doc Blaine. I well remember the night Doc Blaine took me again out to old Jim Garfield's farm. I was in Shifty Corlin's joint, trying to drink enough of the slop he called beer to get a kick out of it, when Doc Blaine came in and persuaded me to go with him. As we drove along the winding old road in Doc's car, I asked, "Why are you so insistent I go with you on this particular night? This isn't a professional call, is it?" "No," he said. "You couldn't kill old Jim with a post-oak maul. He's completely recovered from injuries that ought to have killed an ox. To tell you the truth, Jack Kirby is in Lost Knob, swearing he'll shoot you on sight. Well, for God's sake, I exclaimed angrily. Now everybody'll think I left town because I was afraid of him. Turn around and take me back, damn it. Be reasonable, said Doc. Everybody knows you're not afraid of Kirby. Nobody's afraid of him now. His bluff's broken. That's why he's so wild against you. But you can't afford to have any more trouble with him now. Your trial's only a short time off. I laughed and said, well, if he's looking for me hard enough, he can find me as easily at old Garfield's as in town. Because Shifty Colin heard you say where you were going. Shifty's hated me ever since I skinned him in that horse swap last fall. Yeah, he'll tell Kirby where I went. Ah, never thought of that, said Doc Blaine, worried. Forget it, I advised. Kirby hasn't got guts enough to do anything but blow. But I was mistaken. Puncture a bully's vanity and you touch his one vital spot. Now, old Jim had not gone to bed when we got there. He was sitting in the room opening onto his sagging porch, the room which was at once living room and bedroom, smoking his old cob pipe and trying to read a newspaper by the light of his coal oil lamp. All the windows and doors were wide open for the coolness, and the insects which swarmed in and fluttered around the lamp didn't seem to bother him. We sat down and discussed the weather, which isn't so insane as one might suppose in a country where men's livelihood depends on sun and rain, and is at the mercy of wind and drought. The talk drifted into other kindred channels, and after some time, Doc Blaine bluntly spoke of something that hung in his mind. Jim, he said, that night I thought you were dying. You babbled a lot of stuff about your heart, and an Indian who lent you his. How much of that was delirium? None, Doc, said Garfield, pulling at his pipe. It was gospel truth. Ghost Man, the Lipan priest of the gods of night, replaced my dead, torn heart with one from something he worshipped. I didn't show myself just what something is. Well, something from way back, a long way off, he said. But being a god, he can do without his heart for a while. But when I die, if I ever get my head smashed so my consciousness is destroyed, the heart must be given back to Ghost Man. You mean you were in earnest about cutting out your heart? Demanded Doc Blaine. Oh, it has to be, answered old Garfield. A living thing and a dead thing is opposed to nature. That's what Ghost Man said. Who the devil was Ghost Man? I told you, a witch doctor of the Lipans who dwelt in this country before the Comanches came down from the Stake Plains and drove them south across the Rio Grande. I was a friend to him. Reckon old Ghost Man is the only one left alive. Alive? Now? I don't know, confessed old Jim. I don't know whether he's alive or dead. Don't know whether he was alive when he came to me after the fight on Locust Creek, or even if he was alive when I knowed him in the southern country. Alive as we understand life, I mean. Gah, what balderdash is this? Demanded Doc Blaine uneasily, and I felt a slight stirring in my hair. Outside was stillness, and the stars, and the black shadows of the post-oak woods. The lamp cast old Garfield's shadow grotesquely on the wall, so it didn't at all resemble that of a human, and his words were strange as words heard in a nightmare. I know what you wouldn't understand, said old Jim. I don't understand myself, and I ain't got the words to explain them things I feel and know without understanding. The Lapans were kin to the Apaches, and the Apaches learned curious things from the Pueblos. Ghost Man was, that's all I can say. Alive or dead, I don't know, but he was. What's more, he is. Oh, is it you or me that's crazy? Asked Doc Blaine. Well, said old Jim, I'll tell you this much. Ghost Man knew Coronado. Crazy as a loon, murmured Doc Blaine. Then he lifted his head. What's that? Horse turning in from the road, I said. Sounds like it stopped. I stepped to the door like a fool and stood etched in the light behind me. I got a glimpse of a shadowy bulk I knew to be a man on a horse. Then Doc Blaine yelled, "Look out!" and threw himself against me, knocking us both sprawling. At the same instant I heard the smashing report of a rifle, and old Garfield grunted and fell heavily. "Jack Kirby!" screamed Doc Blaine. "He's killed him!" I scrambled up, hearing the clatter of retreating hooves, snatched old Jim's shotgun from the wall, rushed recklessly out onto the sagging porch, and let go both barrels at the fleeing shape, dim in the starlight. The charge was too light to kill at that range, but the birdshot stung the horse and maddened him. He swerved, crashed headlong through a rail fence, and charged across the orchard, and a peach tree limb knocked his rider out of the saddle. He never moved after he hit the ground. I ran up there and looked down at him. It was Jack Kirby right enough, and his neck was broken like a rotten branch. I let him lie and ran back to the house. Doc Blaine had stretched old Garfield out on a bench he'd dragged in from the porch. Doc's face was whiter than I'd ever seen it. Old Jim was a ghastly sight. He'd been shot with an old-fashioned .45-70. And at that range, the heavy ball had literally torn off the top of his head. His features were masked with blood and brains. He'd been directly behind me, poor old devil, and he'd stopped the slug meant for me. Doc Blaine was trembling, although he was anything but a stranger to such sights. "Would you pronounce him dead?" he asked. "That's for you to say," I answered, "but even a fool could tell that he is dead." "He is dead," said Doc Blaine in a strained, unnatural voice. "Rigor mortis is already setting in, but feel his heart." I did, and I cried out. The flesh was already cold and clammy, but beneath it, that mysterious heart still hammered away steadily, like a dynamo in a deserted house. No blood coursed through those veins, and yet the heart pounded. Pounded and pounded, like the pulse of eternity. "A living thing in a dead thing," whispered Doc Blaine, cold sweat on his face. "This is opposed to nature. I'm going to keep the promise I made him. I'll assume full responsibility. This is too monstrous to ignore." Our implements were a butcher knife and a hacksaw. Outside, only the still stars looked down on the black post-oak shadows and the dead man that lay in the orchard. Inside, the old lamp flickered, making strange shadows move and shiver and cringe in the corners, and glistened on the blood on the floor, and the red dabbled figure on the bench. The only sound inside was the crunch of the saw edge on bone. Outside, an owl began to hoot weirdly. Doc Blaine thrust a red-stained hand into the aperture he'd made and drew out a red, pulsing object that caught the lamplight. With a choked cry, he recoiled, and the thing slipped from his fingers and fell on the table. And I, too, cried out involuntarily. For it did not fall with a soft, meaty thud as a piece of flesh should fall. It thumped hard on the table. Impelled by an irresistible urge, I bent and gingerly picked up old Garfield's heart. The feel of it was brittle, unyielding, like steel or stone, but smoother than either. In size and shape, it was a duplicate of a human heart, but it was slick and smooth, and its crimson surface reflected the lamplight like a jewel more lambent than any ruby, and in my hand it still throbbed mightily, sending vibratory radiations of energy up my arm until my own heart seemed swelling and bursting in response. It was cosmic power, beyond my comprehension, concentrated into the likeness of a human heart. The thought came to me that here was a dynamo of life, the nearest approach to immortality that's possible for the destructible human body. The materialization of a cosmic secret more wonderful than the fabulous fountain sought for by Ponce de Leon. My soul was drawn into that unterrestrial gleam, I suddenly wished passionately that it hammered and thundered in my own bosom in place of my paltry heart of tissue and muscle. Doc Blaine ejaculated incoherently. I wheeled. The noise of his coming had been no greater than the whispering of a night wind through the corn. There in the doorway he stood, tall, dark, inscrutable. An Indian warrior in the paint, war bonnet, breech clout and moccasins of an elder age. His dark eyes burn like fires gleaming deep under fathomless black lakes. Silently he extended his hand, and I dropped Jim Garfield's heart into it. And then, without a word, he turned and stalked into the night. But when Doc Blaine and I rushed out into the yard an instant later, there was no sign of any human being. He'd vanished like a phantom of the night, and only something that looked like an owl was flying, dwindling from sight into the rising moon.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
And now, sadly, it's time to round off our tales of terror with The Abominations of Yondu by Clark Ashton Smith.
The sand of the desert of Yondu is not as the sand of other deserts, for Yondu lies nearest of all to the world's rim. And strange winds, blowing from a pit no astronomer may hope to fathom, have sown its ruinous fields with the grey dust of corroding planets, the black ashes of extinguished suns. The dark, orb-like mountains which rise from its wrinkled and pitted plain are not all its own, for some have fallen asteroids half buried in that abysmal sand. Things have crept in from nether space, whose incursion is forbid by the gods of all proper and well-ordered lands. But there are no such gods in Yondu, where live the hoary genii of stars abolished and decrepit demons left homeless by the destruction of antiquated hells. It was noon of a vernal day when I came forth from that interminable cactus forest in which the inquisitors of Ong had left me, and saw at my feet the grey beginnings of Yondu. I repeat, it was noon on a vernal day, but in that fantastic wood I'd found no token or memory of a spring, and the swollen, fulvous, dying and half-rotten growths through which I'd pushed my way were like no other cacti, but rather bore shapes of abomination scarcely to be described. The very air was heavy with stagnant odors of decay, and leprous lichens mottled the black soil and russet vegetation with increasing frequency. Pale green vipers lifted their heads from prostrate cactus boles and watched me with eyes of bright ochre that had no lids or pupils. These things had disquieted me for hours past, and I did not like the monstrous fungi with hueless stems and nodding heads of poisonous mauve, which grew from the sodden lips of fetid tarns, and the sinister ripples spreading and fading on the yellow water at my approach were not reassuring to one whose nerves were still taut from unmentionable tortures. Then, when even the blotched and sickly cacti became more sparse and stunted, and reels of ash and sand crept in among them, I began to suspect how great was the hatred my heresy had aroused in the priests of Ong, and to guess the ultimate malignancy of their vengeance. I will not detail the indiscretions which had led me, a careless stranger from far-off lands, into the power of those dreadful magicians and mysteriarchs who serve the lion-headed Ong. These indiscretions, and the particulars of my arrest, are painful to remember, and least of all do I like to remember the racks of dragon guts strewn with powdered and adamant, on which men are stretched naked, or that unlit room with 6-inch windows near the sill, where bloated corpse worms crawled in by the hundreds from a neighbouring catacomb. Sufficient to say that After expending the resources of their frightful fantasy, my inquisitors had borne me blindfolded on camelback for incomputable hours, to leave me at morning twilight in that sinister forest. I was free, they told me, to go whither I would, and in token of the clemency of Ong, they gave me a loaf of coarse bread and a leathern bottle of rank water by way of provision. It was of noon that same day that I came to the desert of Yondu. So far I had not thought of turning back, for all the horror of those rotting cacti or the evil things that dwelt among them. But now I paused, knowing the abominable legend of the land to which I had come, for Yondu is a place where few have ventured wittingly and of their own accord. Fewer still have returned, babbling of unknown horrors and strange treasure, and the lifelong palsy which shakes their withered limbs, together with the mad gleam in their startling eyes, beneath widened brows and lashes, is not an incentive for others to follow. So it was that I hesitated on the verge of those ashen sands, and felt the tremor of a new fear in my wrenched vitals. It was dreadful to go on, and dreadful to go back, for I felt sure that the priests had made provision against the latter contingency. So after a little while, I went forward, singing at each step in loathly softness, and followed by certain long-legged insects that I had met among the cacti. These insects were the color of a week-old corpse, and were as large as tarantulas. But when I turned and trod upon the foremost, a mephitic stench arose that was more nauseous even than their color. So, for the nonce, I ignored them as much as possible. Indeed, such things were minor horrors in my predicament. Before me, under a huge sun of sickly scarlet, Yondu reached interminable as the land of a hashish dream against the black heavens. Far off, on the utmost rim, were those orb-like mountains of which I'd been told. But in between were awful blanks of grey desolation, and low, treeless hills like the backs of half-buried monsters. Struggling on, I saw great pits where meteors had sunk from sight, and diverse colored jewels that I could not name glared or glistened from the dust. There were fallen cypresses that rotted by crumbling mausoleums, on whose lichen-blotted marble fat chameleons crept with royal pearls in their mouths. Hidden by the low ridges were cities of which no stella remained unbroken, immense and immemorial cities lapsing shard by shard, atom by atom, to feed infinities of desolation. I dragged my torture-weakened limbs over vast rubbish heaps that had once been mighty temples, and fallen gods frowned in rotting passamite, or leered in riven porphyry at my feet. Over all was an evil silence, broken only by the satanic laughter of hyenas and the rustling of adders in thickets of dead thorn or antique gardens given to the perishing nettle and fumitory. Topping one of the many mound-like ridges, I saw the waters of a weird lake, unfathomably dark and green as malachite, and set with bars of profulgent salt. These waters lay far beneath me in a cup-like hollow, but almost at my feet on the wave-worn slopes were heaps of that ancient salt, and I knew that the lake was only the bitter and ebbing dregs of some former sea. Climbing down, I came to the dark waters, and began to lave my hands, but there was a sharp and corrosive sting in that immemorial brine, and I desisted quickly, preferring the desert dust that had wrapped me about like a slow shroud. Here, I decided to rest for a while, and hunger forced me to consume part of the meagre and mocking fare with which I had been provided by the priests. It was my intention to push on, if my strength would allow, and reach the lands that lie to the north of Yondu. Now, these lands are desolate, indeed, but their desolation is of a more usual than that of Yondu, and certain tribes of nomads have been known to visit them occasionally. If fortune favoured me, I might fall in with one of these tribes. The scant fare revived me, and for the first time in weeks, of which I had lost all reckoning, I heard the whisper of a faint hope. Corpse-coloured insects had long since ceased to follow me, and so far, despite the eeriness of the sepulchral silence and the mounded dust of timeless ruin, I'd met nothing half so horrible as those insects. I began to think that the terrors of yonder were somewhat exaggerated. It was then that I heard a diabolic chuckle on the hillside above me. The sound began with a sharp abruptness that startled me beyond all reason, and continued endlessly, never varying its single note, like the mirth of an idiotic demon. I turned and saw the mouth of a dark cave, fanged with green stalactites, which I had not perceived before. The sound appeared to come from within this cave. With a fearful intentness, I stared at the black opening. The chuckle grew louder, but for a while I could see nothing. At last I caught a whitish glimmer in the darkness. Then, with all the rapidity of nightmare, a monstrous thing emerged. It had a pale, hairless, egg-shaped body, large as that of a gravid she-goat, and this body was mounted on 9 long, wavering legs with many flanges, like the legs of some enormous spider. The creature ran past me to the water's edge, and I saw that there were no eyes in its oddly sloping face, but 2 knife-like ears rose high above its head, and a thin, wrinkled snout hung down across its mouth, whose flabby lips, parted in that eternal chuckle, revealed rows of bat's teeth. It drank acidly of the bitter lake. Then, with thirst satisfied, it turned and seemed to sense my presence, for the wrinkled snout rose and pointed toward me, sniffing audibly. Whether the creature would have fled, or whether it meant to attack me, I do not know, for I could bear the sight no longer, but ran with trembling limbs amid the massive boulders and great bars of salt along the lake shore. Utterly breathless, I stopped at last, and saw that I was not pursued. I sat down, still trembling, in the shadow of a boulder. But I was to find little respite, for now began the second of those bizarre adventures which forced me to believe all the mad legends I'd heard. More startling even than that diabolic chuckle was a scream that rose at my very elbow from the salt-compounded sand. The scream of a woman possessed by some atrocious agony, or helpless in the grip of devil. Turning, I beheld a veritable Venus, naked in a white perfection that could fear no scrutiny, but immersed to her navel in the sand. Her terror-widened eyes implored me, and her lotus hands reached out with beseeching gesture. I sprang to her side and touched a marble statue, whose carved lips were drooped in some enigmatic dream of dead cycles, and whose hands were buried with the lost loveliness of hips and thighs. Again I fled, shaken with a new fear, and again I heard the scream of a woman's agony. But this time I did not turn to see the imploring eyes and hands. Up the long slope to the north of that accursed lake, stumbling over boulders of basanite and ledges that were sharp with verdigris-covered metals, floundering in pits of salt, on terraces wrought by the receding tide in ancient eons, I fled as a man flies from dream to baleful dream of some coco-demonical night. But whiles, there was a cold whisper in my ear, which did not come from the wind of my flight. And looking back, as I reached one of the upper terraces, I perceived a singular shadow that ran pace by pace with my own. This shadow was not the shadow of man or ape nor any beast. The head was too grotesquely elongated, the squat body too gibbous, and I was unable to determine whether the shadow possessed 5 legs or whether what appeared to be the 5th was merely a tail. Terror lent me new strength, and I'd reached the hilltop when I dared to look back again. But still, the fantastic shadow kept pace by pace with mine, and now I caught a curious and utterly sickening odour, as foul as the odour of bats who've hung in a charnel house amid the mould of corruption. I ran for leagues, while the red sun slanted above the asteroidal mountains to the west, and the weird shadow lengthened with mine, but always kept at the same distance behind me. An hour before sunset, I came to a small circle of pillars that rose miraculously unbroken amid ruins that were like a vast pile of potsherds. As I passed among these pillars, I heard a whimper, like the whimper of some fierce animal, between rage and fear, and saw that the shadow had not followed me within the circle. I stopped and waited, conjecturing at once that I'd found a sanctuary my unwelcome familiar would not dare to enter, and in this the action of the shadow confirmed me. The thing hesitated, then ran about the circle of columns, pausing often between them, and whimpering all the while, at last went away and disappeared in the desert toward the setting sun. For a full half hour, I did not dare to move. Then the imminence of night, with all its probabilities of fresh terror, urged me to push on as far as I could to the north. For I was now in the very heart of yonder where demons or phantoms might dwell, who would not respect the sanctuary of the unbroken columns. Now, as I toiled on, the sunlight altered strangely, for the red orb nearing the mounded horizon sank and smouldered in a belt of miasmal haze, where floating dust from all the shattered fanes and necropoly of yonder was mixed with evil vapours coiling skyward from the black, enormous gulfs lying beyond the utmost rim of the world. In that light, the entire waste, the rounded mountains, the serpentine hills, the lost cities were all drenched with phantasmal and darkening scarlet. Then, out of the north, where shadows mustered, there came a curious figure, a tall man, fully caparisoned in chainmail, or rather, what I assumed to be a man. As the figure approached me, clanking dismally at each step on the shrouded ground, I saw that his armor was of brass mottled with verdigris, and a casque of the same metal furnished with coiling horns and a serrate comb rose high above its head. Now, I say its head, for the sunset was darkening, and I could not clearly see at any distance. But when the apparition came abreast, I perceived that there was no face beneath the brows of the bizarre helmet whose empty edges were outlined for a moment against the smouldering light. Then the figure passed on, still clanking dismally, and vanished. But on its heels, the sunset faded. There came a second apparition, striding with incredible strides and halting when it loomed almost upon me in the red twilight. The monstrous mummy of some ancient king, still crowned with untarnished gold, but turning to my gaze a visage that more than time or the worm had wasted. Broken swathings flapped about the skeleton legs, and above the crown that was set with sapphires and orange rubies, a black something swayed and nodded horribly. But for an instant, I did not dream what it was. Then, in its middle, two oblique and scarlet eyes opened and glowed like hellish coals, and two ophidian fangs glittered in an ape-like mouth. A squat, furless, shapeless head on a neck of disproportionate extent leaned unspeakably down and whispered in the mummy's ear. Then, with one stride, the titanic leg took off the distance between us, and from out the folds of the tattered cerecloth a gaunt arm rose, and fleshless, taloned fingers laden with glowering gems reached out and fumbled for my throat. Back through eons of madness and dread, in a prone, precipitate flight, I ran from those fumbling fingers that hung always on the dust behind me. Back forever, unthinking, unhesitating, to all the abominations I had left. Back in the thickening twilight toward the nameless and sharded ruins, the haunted lake, the forest of evil cacti, and the cruel, cynical inquisitors of Ong, who waited my return.
I do so hope you enjoyed those four classic tales by some of the greatest horror writers of all time for your listening pleasure this evening. Well, the time has come for me to say goodbye, but I'll be back again next week, and I do so hope you'll all join me again then. So until next time, sweet dreams and bye-bye.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
L-E-T-E-N-P-C. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.